My first question has to do with some of the honors that you have received and how things happened that way. You've been Society of Professional Archaeologists president and the president of the Society for American Archaeology, and notably appointed to the American Academy of Sciences. You've accomplished a great deal. I'm curious to know why you accomplished so much, how that came about. What qualities that you think you have that led to that success?
Well, I think it was a fluke of ac an accident that caused me to really get involved in all of this. Undoubtedly, while I had already established a reputation as a highly motivated young man who went into archaeology after a period of time in the military, and I had always wanted to be an archaeologist, and this gave me and when I came back from the military, I finished my bachelor's degree at the University of Arizona and went off to Harvard, and I was there for 2 years while I did my doctoral research, and that led to my first sort of unusual archaeology. And that as I was finishing my doctoral excavations in the Petrified Forest in northeastern Arizona, I was contacted. Well, I guess I ought to put it the way it was. I first noticed that there was an airplane circling my camp and up in the sky, and I didn't pay him too much attention, but they went away in 15, 20 minutes, and then about an hour after that, there was a car pulled up on the highway and stopped. And great big fella gets out of the car. He says, "Is this Windorf Camp?" And I said, "Yes, I'm Fred Windorf. What can I do for you?" And he said, "I'm coming down." So he walked down and came up and he stuck out his big paw about half the size of mine, and he said, "Dr. Windorf, no, not he didn't say Dr. Windorf, Fred Windorf. I want to have very pleased to meet you, and I came to offer a job to you, and I want you to start tomorrow." And well, I couldn't start tomorrow because I had a camp and I had people, I had equipment to put away, I had vehicle to take back to the dealer that had let me have a loan to the vehicle, and but then I did get started, and that was really this beginning when the world stood back and looked and saw something in me, I think, and it we did. We were racing against time. We hired five archaeologists, four plus me, as the director of the whole project. And it was for a pipeline that went from Farmington, New Mexico, all the way to California.
So this man was looking for somebody to run a project, and he wanted somebody with certain qualities. Well, why did he pick you?
Well, he was. I had two friends who recommended him. Both of them had been involved in my dissertation research. Dr. Harold Colton, who was the director of the Museum of Northern Arizona, had, I don't know whether it was his money, but certainly his equipment and his, and he came to me with grants from some foundation that I'd never heard about. And he also got some small grants from like the Colt Foundation and so on, a few hundred dollars for each of my 2 seasons in the field. And also some of the field equipment I had borrowed from the Museum of New Mexico, and because I had been given the job as his assistant, this head of the Laboratory of Anthropology, as his assistant while he ran a field school in the previous summer. And they came in there asking people, this man Nussbaum was asking people who they thought might be able and willing to run such a project, and both of them had said Windorf.
All right, so are you saying it was because you had connections, or did you have certain qualities that people were attracted to or thought or respected?
Well, I'm pretty sure they thought I would had had qualities to push hard.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure they also realized that I was reasonably bright and highly motivated. And it happened that both of those gentlemen also had important jobs in American Southwestern, particularly Southwestern archaeology. One was director of the museum in Northern Arizona, and the other was the director of the Laboratory of Anthropology in Santa Fe. Their opinions would be respected, particularly by Nussbaum. And we got along. That's another important part.
Well, that's good. And let me just stop you right there and ask you another question that I wanted to get to early on, and that is about this book. Now, not every archaeologist who has a career writes a book. Now, why did you write a book?
Well, I'm not just any archaeologist, and I knew that. And I knew that I'd had a very interesting life. After all, I had done some digging in the Petrified Forest, which is also a little bit of a challenge. If you've ever been there, you can understand why it was a challenge. And then when I started working in Africa, this also brought a lot of attention to people, because on the way there, I did a satisfactory job, at least on the pipeline archaeology. We were excavating sites. There was a line of stakes that we were trying to follow. Behind us, we could hear the bulldozers, and so the people were trying to dig the sites that they found and get out of the way, because that was one of the things that was important to us, that we didn't cause the pipeline people undue cost.
Well, have you always thought about writing a book, or is that something
never thought about it. My family had occasionally said, you should write a story about this, Dad, or you should write, and some friends, there were quite a few friends who noticed that I was doing things that were kind of unusual. And that pipeline thing was unusual because we had an accident, and at Nussbaum had gotten Time and Life magazines interested in the project, and they sent a crew of photographers and so on and writers out, and they made a big story about El Paso Gas Company doing this revolutionary kind of archaeology. And we had some stuff to show them, pretty things with burials and pueblo rooms and pit houses and so on, because we were digging like mad.
Mm-hmm.
And so we got a lot of publicity about it. Now, I already knew this was important because, by and large, in the United States, in 1950, the intellectual, scholarly world and the popular world didn't give a damn about saving archaeology. There was no value placed upon it. And I knew that this was something that was going on. I knew in my heart. And part of that came from the fact that my professor at Harvard at that time was a man named Joe Brew, and he had been organizing concern among the population of the United States, writing articles, doing newspaper stories, doing things, and helping, and particularly going after the archaeologists who lived in the Missouri Basin, where they were going to, the Army and the Corps of Engineers was going to build a lot of dams out there and reservoirs, and they were going to destroy thousands of sites. So pipelines, people didn't care about pipelines. Highways, people didn't know about it, didn't care about it. And so there was this fellow, Joe Brew, and one of his close associates over there, and a friend named Fred Johnson. These two guys began to light the light on the archaeological world and in the public world that we ought to take some interest in this. And when we got this big story in Time and Life magazine, this was all of us, all five of us plus Nussbaum, all knew we were doing something new and different and exciting.
And this was in the early 50s, isn't it?
This was 1950.
Mm-hmm.
And I did three of these things with Nussbaum, and then I finally said, Jess, I quit. I can't do this because doing pipeline archaeology is hard, and it requires lots of foot power, and it mm-hmm. requires a lot of energy and determination and mm-hmm. so on.
Looking back on that time and remembering what it was like before that, can you describe how significant that change was? I mean, people starting to become interested in what was called salvage archaeology.
Mm-hmm.
How important was that in the history of archaeology in America?
It changed Americans' attitude toward our cultural heritage. That was the first step in changing it. Well, Noose's first step actually was Joe Brews and Fred Johnson's going after the people in the Corps of Engineers and so on in the Missouri Basin. And that first got, but they didn't get enough publicity to change a lot of things. It did change a lot of attitudes on the part of archaeologists, who by and large in the 1930s and 40s, they didn't care. Nobody on the scale during the WPA days when they dug lots of archaeological sites were essentially made work things for WPA and so on. They dug lots of sites. None of them, almost none of them ever published nothing important. There were a few, but by and large, they were high quality of archaeology that never got reported, never got done, because the community, the archaeological community, wasn't really behind that.
And another part of that that struck me was the size of some of the projects you got involved with. There were large sums of money devoted to the pipeline project. Correct me if I'm wrong, but archaeology previously had not been nearly so well funded.
That's correct. And there was another thing. Because I made a foolish perhaps comment. I was giving a lecture about the pipeline. Well, the last of the pipeline projects, as far as I was concerned, had been finished, and they had invited me to come and give a talk at the Rotary Club there in Santa Fe. And so I gave this talk and showed a few slides of the pipeline excavations, and it's rather dramatic to have these big trenches and the big pipe and all that stuff. And there's these guys digging away at an archaeological site. And so I showed some of these, and then at the end of it, I had three or four slides I'd taken while driving up and down Highway 66.
Which was then the main road between Albuquerque and Gallup, New Mexico. After I showed the slides, I made the comment, isn't it too bad that our state agencies like the Highway Department and the Federal Bureau of Public Roads don't abide by our antiquities laws as well as private industry? And unknowns to me, there was the gentleman in the audience who was the Federal Bureau of Public Roads. He was the state director for that organization. And he walked up to me and introduced himself, and I felt about the size of a small penny. And he could tell I was embarrassed, and he said, no. He said, it happened that a few days ago, I was with the chief highway engineer of New Mexico. That's a state man. And he and I witnessed the destruction of a large pueblo up the Rio Chama. And we commented to each other about what we could do to stop the destruction of archaeological sites by highway construction. And then he said, could you meet with me and the chief highway engineer later this week? And I said, of course, yes, I can. And he said, well, give me your telephone number, and I will see if I can set up an appointment, and we'll meet with a fellow named Pete Irwin. And he said, I think you'll find him very helpful. And as we were about to break up, I said, wouldn't it be possible if I could bring along Jess Nussbaum? He was a man who was really responsible for the pipeline archaeology project and was my boss on that. And I know he'd be interested and helpful. And he said, oh, by all means, I know Jess, and he'd be an important contributor. So we parted, and then later that day, I got a phone call from Pete Irwin and said, well, our meeting is scheduled for Thursday. I think that's what it was. And I don't really have a note on that. But it was that week, and he said, Irwin is very anxious to meet with you and Jess Nussbaum. So at the appointed time, we went over to the, Nussbaum and I went over to the highway department where Spike Keller, the gentleman I met at the Kiwanis Club, took me in and introduced me to Pete Irwin and several of his upper division personnel, and we chatted a few minutes, and then Pete said, "Well, I've been giving some thought to this thing, and I've got an idea how we can make this thing work." And he said, "Let's agree that we'll be nothing on paper. It's going to be an understanding between us here. And as far as I can tell, it will be the first nationally recognized or national statewide archaeological salvage program on highways anywhere in the United States, or maybe anywhere. And then he ticked down the list of seven or eight items. First, how we would get to the surveys and who would do them. That was me. And because there was nobody else at the museum to do this stuff. And fortunately, I had mentioned this discussion was going to take place to my boss at the museum. And he had agreed to what generally had in mind. And then it went on down that I would tell them about any sites I found. I would pick up maps and drawings of the areas of where the new highway would be constructed, and then I'd walk that right away. And if I found a site that I wanted to excavate, I called up the headquarters and told them that, and they would arrange for the labor that I would say if I needed 6 laborers or 10 laborers or whatever I needed, they would provide them from their construction staffs and maintenance staffs. And so he and then there was nothing really more specific than that, but that's pretty specific. When I would have to go and survey from 4 to 6 sites, from 4 to 6 of the projects that were being let that month for construction. And that would be later that month it would be let. And then if I had found sites, I should immediately notify them, and I did begin to find sites. And I was finally running around the state like a chicken with his head cut off, trying to keep up with all the work. And the legislature was meeting a few months later, and during when that met, there was an item on the budget that was approved by the legislature that I'd never heard about, and neither did my boss, the director of the Museum of New Mexico. And he was not very happy about it. The thing said it was $10,000 appropriated to the Museum of New Mexico for their highway archaeological salvage program. You can imagine what the director felt when he read that.
And how much money was that, Fred?
Pardon?
How much money was that?
$10,000. That was a lot of money then.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was money that I could use. He had observed that I was doing a lot of running around, I guess, and that I was finding sites, and he could tell I was probably needing some help. And so he thought that would be enough for me to at least get somebody part-time to help me, which I did. And it wasn't very long until we were excavating quite a bit of the sites. We couldn't make every one because sometimes I had 2 or 3 things all going at the same time, and I would have to say, well, I can do this one, but not this one. So we didn't make 100%, but we made a lot of sites.
So that was the beginning of the first highway archaeology program. And that was, what year was that? Was that 1950?
It would have been about 1950, about 1953 or 54.
Okay. And
pardon?
Did that program ever really end?
No, it's still going on.
Mm-hmm. How long were you involved with that program?
Well, I was involved until I left and went over to Lubbock to be the associate director of the museum over there and associate professor and I was to be the first archaeologist first anthropologist they'd had on the faculty there at Texas Tech.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a lot more money than I'd been making at the Museum of Mexico, and I had a lot more freedom about what I would do, because frankly the highway program was just eating my lunch. I really couldn't keep up with it, but it's still going on.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things I negotiated with the highway department before I left, and I heard a year or so ago from the man that I hired at that time to do it, that he thought that the program was still going on. I'd asked that a statewide survey be done of all existing highways and public roads, and that this would be many years in the course, because we'd have over, say you have two people assigned to it, and two archaeologists, that they would have some, well, I'd suggest you get a house trailer, and they would survey an area that was, say, 100 yards on each side of existing highways, and if they found sites, they would be marked on the detail maps that the highway department provided us. So that if they came in and enlarged or made minor changes in a highway, they would know that there was an archaeological site possibly there, and if it was absolutely necessary that the change be made in, as they designed it, then they would try to excavate it. If not, they'd simply mark it. And of course, some of these projects didn't happen. There were miles and miles and miles of stuff that there was no site within 100 yards on each side of the existing right-of-way.
Now, Fred, I'd like to move forward to what was perhaps the biggest change in your career, the biggest shift, and that was the shift to Nubia. Can you tell us how and why that came about? How did you go from southwest in New Mexico all the way over to northeastern Africa?
Could I also tell you what happened when I went over to Lubbock?
Sure.
Because that's kind of important here.
Okay, go ahead.
I went over there, before I went over there to Lubbock, the summer of, I think it was 1956. Yes, I believe it was the summer of 1956. I attended a symposium in Albuquerque at the university there on climate change and environmental changes in the desert areas of the American Southwest, something like that. I don't remember exactly the title, so you'll have to look in my book to find that, because I had that at hand in my book, and I don't have a copy of that handy here. And while I was at this conference, I saw a nice lady, middle-aged lady, who's Catherine Clisby was her name, and I went over and introduced myself to her and thanked and told her how much I'd enjoyed the paper she and her associate had given at the meeting, when I told her my name, I also said that I'd been working in the American Southwest at the Midland site, and a book that had just been published, I guess, the year before. I said, but we didn't find any pollen in the, and she was a palynologist, a pollen specialist. And I said, I didn't find any pollen in any of the sediments, although we had it checked for pollen. And she said, maybe you need a new pollen analyst. I remember those words pretty clearly, and she was telling me she was a tough little cookie. Anyway, Catherine Clisby, I said, well, we were chatting along, and I said, someday I'm going to take you out to the Llano Estacado and the eastern New Mexico, and I want to show you some of those blowout basins out there and the lake sediments that are in those things. And her ears picked up, and she said, let's go today. I said, I can't go today, but I could go tomorrow. And I called up my boss in Santa Fe and got permission to take the car and get a car. And so I had a car with me, but I was at this meeting. So I got my clothes and she got checked. I guess she brought her bag. I don't remember anything about that detail, but we went over to Clovis and drove around, and I showed her the Blackwater Draw site and the lake sediments there on the highway between Clovis and Portales, and then over to one of the fossil lakes, a big fossil lake over there. And she looked at the sediments there, and she said, I've seen enough. Let's go in back to town. and she went in and stomped into the, and they said, I want to go see the people at the Soil Conservation Service. She said, they've got some tools there that I need. And she walked in the door, and she announced in a very triumphant time, my name is Catherine Clisby, and this is Fred Windorf, and I'd like to meet with whoever's the head of your office here. And in a few minutes, he came out, and she introduced herself and told her that she was a pollen analyst. And she said, I've seen some lake sediments over a few miles to the east of here that look awfully good to me, and I'm sure they're going to have pollen in them. And she said, could you have one of those things that punch down the core and you get about a 4-foot coral? And he said, yes, I do. And it was on the back of the Jeep. And he said, well, could I borrow it for a couple hours with a driver? And he said, well, I'll come with you. And anyway, we went over there and we got some pollen samples. We had them all wrapped up and numbered and everything, and in tubes at the people there at the Soil Conservation Service had provided us, and we bundled those up and put them in my car. And as we were driving home, she said, those things have got pollen in them, Fred. And said, I want you to come and meet Paul Sears. He's the man that I work with, and he's on the National Science Foundation board. He may be chairman, I don't know, but she said he can be of help to us because he's going to be interested in this too. And cut it short, well, I met Paul Sears and Clisby, and they had a little pab, and then she came to him and said, you got to put in a grant proposal, and that was the environmental section in the National Science Foundation. And anyway, I left the next day and went to, and about 2 or 3 days later, or maybe about a week later, I went over to Lubbock to move my family and so on over there. And about 2 weeks later, got a call from Clisby. Have you written that proposal yet? And this went on for about 3 weeks or 4 weeks. And finally, I sat down and wrote the proposal. And that's how I got interested in paleoenvironmental studies of paleoenvironments in the Llano Estacado, and it ended up in a couple of important books that were very controversial, I guess you'd say, because they suggested there'd been the pine spruce woodlands on the Llano Estacado when those lakes were existing about 20,000 to 17,000 years ago, somewhere in that range.
So that experience and that interest in paleoenvironment,
was
that what led you to go to Northeast Africa?
No, it didn't. But I tell you what, it did get me. I got an offer to go back to the Museum of New Mexico as the associate director and the director of research. So I took the job. Of course, it was even more money than I had been making at Lubbock, but more importantly, I really love Santa Fe and the opportunity to continue some research and so on. But at any rate, the first year of the Llano program was I was still at Lubbock when I was there, and then I took what was left of the, I had a 2-year project, and I took the second year with me back to the Museum of Mexico. There's a couple of books on that work. I got another grant two more years later to continue the study on the Llano in more detail. The first one, Paleoecology of the Llano Estacado or something like that, was published in about 1956, I think, or maybe. No, it was a little later than that, about 1960. And then another one that was on late Pleistocene environments on the Llano Estacado, published also by Fort Bergwin. Both those were. I'd hired two paleontologists for the second one. It was a very interesting, I was very interested in that research. And in fact, I was still involved with it when, in 1961, I read in the paper, and I remember I'm in charge of all the research, and one of the chores is to develop research projects for the curators or various curators and other staff there at the Museum of New Mexico. And I read in the newspaper that the U.S. Congress had just appropriated, I think it was $3 million for research in the Aswan Reservoir, and studied the archaeology of the Aswan Reservoir in the Egypt and Sudan. And,
right, now that was when they were planning to build that huge dam on the Nile River, isn't that right?
Yes, I knew that most of the work was going to be, it was pharaonic material, and I didn't know anything about pharaonic material, and I didn't think I was going to be interested in it, but I was riding with a fellow named Jim Hester, I'd hired to bird dog the, he was the actual field man director of the second phase of the Llano Estacado report. And he and I were driving over to look at a basin that we thought might contain pollen to just try to decide whether we're going to spend the money and time to excavate another lake deposit. And on the way, he said, "Did you see that newspaper story about what the Congress did about the money for the Aswan Dam and Egypt and Sudan?" And I said, "Yes." And he said, "Well, are you going to apply?" And I said, "Well, I hadn't given it any consideration because I thought I don't know anything, or none of us here at the museum know anything about pharaonic material, so I don't think we'd be very appropriate." And he said, "Well, I wasn't thinking about the pharaonic remains. I was thinking about the prehistoric archaeology, like the Paleolithic stuff that's there." And he said, "Nobody knows anything about that." And he said, "You've been running directing big projects over here," and he said, "That's going to be a big project there." He said, "And if you decide you want to go, I want to come with you." So that's the real beginning. And I guess it was probably a month later, I'd been mulling over this thing about the Aswan Dam and the Paleolithic, and I said, "I don't know any more about the Paleolithic than I did about the pharaonic, but nobody else does either." So, and I thought, "Well, I'll call my old professor at Harvard. I've learned that he's one of the co-chairs of the UNESCO the UNESCO organization that was going to decide who got money to go to Egypt and Sudan to do the archaeology there." And I called him on the phone and told him I was interested, and he told me all. He said, "Well, that's great, Fred, but I got to tell you, I've been trying to get somebody senior to go and do that project over there, and everybody that I talk to who knows anything at all about archaeology in that area doesn't think there'll be anything there worth working on, and they refuse to come and waste their time on it." And he went on in that vein for saying, and because one, they thought that nobody had ever found any living sites there. And there were six or eight reasons he gave that were that are in the book that tell us why nobody that was senior that knew anything about it was interested in working there. And finally he said, "How do you, now that you've heard all the negative things, what do you think? Are you still interested?" I said, "I am still interested." Joe, his name was Joe Brew, did I mention that earlier? Anyway, are you interested in Joe? Because I'm interested because I believe they're wrong. I think one of the great waterways of the world is bound to have lots of archaeology, and it'll be of interest to excavate that and study it, because even if it's primitive or more primitive or cruder than the things in Europe, it will still be a very interesting study, and we'll learn a lot about people and people there. Yes, I'm interested. I'd very like to try it." And he said, "Well, that's good, Fred." And I said, "You do two proposals, one for the State Department, and that will be for work in Egypt, and the others will go to the National Science Foundation for work in Sudan, and it'll be in dollars. The Egyptian one will be in pounds." He said, "Write two proposals, and I'll send you the address for the State Department. The other one just goes to the anthropology program at the National Science Foundation." One of my favorite stories here is about to come out now. Unbeknownst to me, Joe Brew and his group had authorized two guys to go on a houseboat from Aswan to Wadi Halfa and to look for sites in the Aswan Reservoir, paleolithic sites. And they went down there and had a few cocktails on the fantail, I guess, and got off the boat here and there and looked around for 10 minutes and got back on and went to Wadi Halfa and monkeyed around there in town and then got back on the boat and came back to Aswan and wrote a report saying they didn't find anything. Not surprising, I might say. On a houseboat, it's not really the way to do a survey of a very large reservoir like that this one is. And they said, we don't recommend that there be any more funds appropriated to do the work in the Aswan Reservoir. And they submitted that, and two or three days later, my proposals hit them, asking for big chunks of money. I don't really remember the details of the money, but they were fairly large proposals, and even then, and when these two gentlemen, one from Yale and the other from Harvard, had not found any sites, and boy, when they had sent in this thing, we don't recommend any funds be appropriated, here was a real slap in the face to them, I guess. I don't know how to explain their behavior, but they wrote me a nearly criminal letter saying what a terrible person I was and didn't have any abilities and didn't have any experience and didn't know anything, even though I'd been digging like mad for years there in the American Southwest. They wrote this, and then they sent copies of it to every archaeologist in the United States and in Europe who might possibly review my proposals. And a big storm kind of developed around that, because I had some friends who thought that perhaps learning about the Paleolithic archaeology was something I might be able to do. And at any rate, there was a big kerfuffle, and on the general side, I think most everybody didn't think it was worthwhile to give all that money to me for work in the Aswan Reservoir. But Brew and Walter Emery, who was his co-chair on the council, as our UNESCO group, they had been pleading with the other members that maybe they ought to give me a grant, and they would. And finally, Bruce said, "Let's give Fred a chance. Let's him find out if there's some archaeology there or not." And Emery said, "I agree with that." And I don't know how, there must have been colluding going on that. And anyway, the other brothers gave in, and I did get the grants, two rather large grants, and one for Egypt and one for Sudan. And that was in May 1962. Mm-hmm. And one of the first things I did was I wrote to archaeologists in, I wrote to archaeologists in Europe that I had known, and asked them to, for if they could recommend people that I might be able to recruit, that I wanted young people who knew quite a bit about Paleolithic typology, and I was also trying to recruit Pleistocene geologists and people of that sort. And I ended up with to Europe in June, late June, and met with François Bord, who's the leading prehistorian in France, who I had met on a previous trip to the States that he'd made a couple of years before. And I'd asked him if he could recommend two people, perhaps advanced doctoral students of his, who knew something about the Lower and Middle Paleolithic. And when I got there, he had recommended that I hire two of his advanced graduate students, John and Genevieve Guichard. And then I went over and met with a Pleistocene geologist who had a lot of experience in African geology, and he was Jean Jehoz de Heisland, and I met also his wife, who was a paleontologist who was about to get her degree, and in that vein, I picked up some people who knew things that I didn't know and was were prepared to help me, and then I went on to a meeting I had helped organize at Burgwartenstein in Austria, and there I met a Polish man whom I was very interested in. He was a very sharp person and very likable, and he and I were sitting around in the evenings chatting to each other, and I asked him one evening if he'd like to go with me to Sudan, and he said yes, and he said when, and I said this fall, and I said how do I get, he still was willing, and I said how do I get you out of Poland, and he said write me a letter, so we sat down and we wrote that letter, and I signed it, and he was in Wadi Halfa by the middle of October.
So in that first year, you pulled together quite an international team of archaeologists and other specialists, and you went on down to the reservoir behind the Aswan Dam, and you found a lot of sites, didn't you?
Oh, yeah. Well, I went over, when I left the Austrian thing, and there was a little meeting going on in France, and I sat by there, and my wife went home at that point, and she'd been with me the whole time up to then. And then I went over to Cairo, and I arrived there, and I didn't receive a very pleasant reception. I went over to his office and met the head of the Egyptian Antiquities, and he said, well, I wasn't very much opposed to your getting that money. And he said, I wanted to spend it on pharaonic materials, and he said, here, you've got a big chunk of that money, and he said, I don't know if I want to give you a permit. And he said, if I do give it, because I might backtrack there in a moment, because one of the things I'd written in the proposal was that I would use vehicles and live in tents, that I'd get four-wheel drive vehicles and have tent camps that are where the people would live, and we'd go out to our surveys and excavations from there. And he said, and if I do give you a permit, it won't let you use vehicles out in the desert. I'll insist that you use camels, and you'll have to live on a houseboat. That defeated everything I was trying to do, because I had to get out on the edge of the reservoir. That's where the sites were going to be, where there were previous levels of the river that were much higher than it is today. And I was going to have to be able to get out there and back. And so that was, they never do that on camels. So I left there very unhappy and pretty sure I wasn't going to, may not be going to work there. But I went over to the University of Cairo and I was going over to meet a palynologist, and pollen specialist, and a botanist, I should say. She wasn't a pollen specialist, she was a botanist. And Clisby had gone with me to Egypt for this purpose, and she being a palynologist, she wanted to do some pollen studies in the reservoir. So I went to over to the university and met with this lady and the botanist there. She was a world-famous personality in that field. And it happened that in the office with her when I came in, and she may have called him, I'm not sure about that. She may have arranged for him to be there because he knew who I was. But there was a gentleman over there in the corner sitting on the counter, and he walked over to me and he said, you remember me, Fred? I'm Rushdie Saeed. And he said, we sat next to each other in Kirk Bryan's geomorphology classes at Harvard. And, well, we had a good visit, and right away I realized that he was an unhappy and bored assistant professor at the university there. And I asked him, he had a very bright mind and had lots of good ideas about the area and so on. And he said, why don't I arrange for you to go out in the desert and see if you can do it and search for archaeological sites from cars or not. And I said, I will do that. And he said, well, I've got a graduate student down the hall. His name was Mahay Issaway, and he has a project out there for the Geological Survey of Egypt out in that reservoir area, and I think it'd be very easy to get you a tour down in there. And so we went down the hall and talked with Mahay, and he agreed to take me and on his project, and I said, well, I'm getting ready to go to Sudan right now, and I've got a ticket already, and could I come back in January and do it then? And so it was arranged that they would figure out a time and that they would meet my plane when I arrived in Aswan, and we'd go from Aswan out into the desert. And that was arranged, and that's how that that thing got started.
I see. So you basically piggybacked on an existing project and demonstrated that method of traveling around, you know, in vehicles, yeah, and living in tents was actually useful.
Yeah. Well, that's exactly what we did. We had two cars, two old beat up Ford cars, two wheel drive, and there were four workmen and another man who was the guide, and we had these. There were three men in each vehicle. Does that work out all right? I think that's when. And in the back, or maybe there was four in one. I've forgotten now exactly how we had them laid out. But then the back, the canvas tent, cans of water, cans and gasoline cans, and all tied down and strapped down. And we lit out and it was a desert completely devoid of all life. And it took us, I arrived there about 10 o'clock in the morning or something like that in Aswan. And those my two friends, Bahay and Rishti, and the whole rest of the crew were all dirty and smelly and everything because they'd been out there for a week already picking up rocks they thought might be Paleolithic artifacts. They were just wind eroded stones and that. And I explained these were not artifacts. They were just ventivacs. And so as we were getting ready to drive out, I emptied out their box of rocks out on the ground with them looking at them very sheepishly. And we drove out first to a place called Dungal Well, where there was some water and a small pool of water. Drinkable water, but we had our own water. So we looked around, and there were lots and lots and lots of flaked artifacts, and it'd been a workshop around there because there were bands of flint out there exposed, and they had been heavily utilized in the past. And after we spent an hour or so looking around there, well, we drove off closer to the river where we set up our tent, and that was to be our camp while we were out there. It was about halfway down the way from Aswan to the Sudanese border. Anyway, it seemed like every little arroyo entering the Nile, any place along there, I found archaeological sites. And I collected about five or six bags of artifacts to bring back to show to the head of the antiquities that there were Paleolithic sites out there.
Let me interrupt just for a moment here. We're going to be running out of time before much longer, and I want to get to some of the big questions.
Okay.
You worked over there in Northeast Africa, in Egypt and Sudan and even Ethiopia for many years.
Yes.
You know, that would be like three and a half decades. Isn't that about right?
That's about right.
Yeah.
No, it's four decades.
Four decades.
Yeah.
Now, I want to ask you some big questions. That what happened there in the early 60s, that fateful decision about sending you over there, what impact do you think that had on the course of scientific research in Northeast Africa?
Oh, I think it was an enormous impact because we found lots of sites. I managed to learn the typology during these first year and a year and a half or so. I worked very closely with the people who were very generous with their knowledge for me, and they helped me. And we made a number of very interesting conclusions as a result of our work there, in both Egypt and Sudan. And I think for one thing, after the work was done in the Aswan Reservoir, and that was clearly an eye-opener for the archaeological world because, in 1965, so 66, I published the first book. It was mostly on Middle Paleolithic and early Paleolithic sites, and they were beautifully done reports done by the French and the Poles and one Englishman. They were really for people to say there weren't any sites in the important sites in that reservoir. They got an eye opener with that one. But then the big book came out in two volumes and a box of maps and profiles and so on that came out in 1968. And it really brought enormous attention to the potential for that area. And that was all done in the area that was going to be inundated. And then I think that there was another factor in this, and that was that I was extremely fortunate, not only with the French couple who helped me, but also with the Poles. They were super excavators and scholars, and they did a magnificent job on the projects that they undertook on the West Bank, and I'm still working with them, although I'm not really working anymore. I've quit 4 years ago doing any field work. Actually, it was in 1999 I formally retired as the director of the Combined Prehistoric Expedition, the group that we had, the names we had given to our group.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there were the only thing that I can say is that it was the archaeology we did was evidently good enough and important enough that people took it took it as an important contribution, but they didn't flock there in numbers to continue the research. I think most people felt that I was the one who was getting the money, and that I should be left alone to get it done. And there was, in addition to our group, which after the reservoir thing, we didn't do anything except go downstream from Aswan and all the way to the Fayum Basin in northern Egypt. And we found and excavated numerous sites during that period. A little bit later, a Belgian group was organized, and they came to me and said, could you recommend a place where we would work? And I said, well, why don't you take that area? And I gave them the area on the East Bank that we last worked. And I said, we are planning to go out into the desert, and we're probably not going to work there, so if you want a concession there, I'll not oppose it. So I asked the antiquities people to give them a permit to work there. And then the other group was a German group who had come to me also and asked if I would help them get a permit to work out in the far western, over in the Gilf Kabir, in the far western part of Egypt. And I had made a week trip out there, and I didn't think there was anything of great importance out there. It was different, but I didn't think there was anything of great importance to us, and it was going to be extremely expensive and difficult to work. And so I helped the Germans with that. And we've all stayed good friends and worked together, worked and kept each other informed and attended each other's meetings and done things like that. So there's been a certain dispersal of knowledge.
Right. Your book has an incredible amount of detail, which I would recommend that everyone take a look at. There's a lot of stories in there, a lot of particulars about the research that took place over decades, which unfortunately we can't get to here in this interview. But you know, there are a couple of areas of research that I think I'd like to hear your comments on. Your research dealt on many, related to many different things, but one thing that perhaps is of interest is the development of modern humans. We know that modern humans evolved in Africa, and your work out there in the Egyptian desert related a lot to that subject. Can you tell us what you think your research has contributed in that area of the development of modern humans?
Well, the Ethiopian work that we did at Central Rift Valley there, and it was important in and related to the question of early modern humans, in that we've just had about 6 months ago, we got more argon dates from those localities there in Lake Zawiya in Ethiopia, and it seems that almost around 280,000 to maybe even 300,000, there is already signs that there's something happening in the population that's in the archaeology that suggests the presence there of a new kind of human, some groups who may have been gradually transforming themselves into something that's going to move into modern humans. I think that's about the best way I could put it. There is one locality there that we dug that has, it's almost certainly, I don't think there's any doubt about that, a human-dug basin that must have been a hut, because the floor of that basin had no inlet and no outlet, so there's not something that was formed by water or wind or something like that. And the floor of that thing was covered with hundreds of tools that had been used and discarded and used and discarded. And during the time when the pit was gradually filling up, so there was a period of time there when this basin was being used perhaps by an extended family. It was too large to be a nuclear family, something like an extended family or a small group of people making these artifacts and using them and then discarding them. And they include in the artifacts there's a technology that's a departure from the technology that was still the majority of the materials was being done with, this more primitive technology based on what's called the Lavawa technique, French term. But it's the new technology was producing blades and bladelets. This was in fairly significant numbers of these things. They were not just one or two accidental pieces, but they were deliberately had, and they had the core technology that produced those were also present.
And what's the age of this feature that you're referring to?
Pardon?
How old is this basin feature with these tools in it?
Argon dates of 280,000 plus or minus 10,000.
Right, now that's quite a bit older than many people feel that modern humans evolved.
Well,
isn't that true?
I have a small bone to pick with Desmond Clark about his the site that he reported on, a group of us reported on it not very long before he died. They have an argon date there of 146,000, I think, something like that. And that they have lower Paleolithic or hand axes also there, which is at that time range and is a no-no. And I would have to say that clearly was an admixture there of some lower Paleolithic material that got mixed in, mm-hmm. even though they proclaim that there's no mixture. I think everybody's being nice and polite, but there's a lot of skepticism about that. And,
right, so you feel that modern humans evolved somewhat earlier than others believe.
Yeah, well, and there are others also join me in that view.
Mm-hmm.
There's quite a group of people, I'd say at least two or three other active people in the field or in Ethiopia and in Kenya feel that they have modern humans behavior traits in the lithics at about the same age.
Mm-hmm.
And there's Allison Brooks is saying that she has a site that may be as old as 400,000 that has some suggestions of modern lithic technology. But she's not going any farther than that.
We only have about a minute to go here. I just want to ask you one more question about significance of your research. And going much later in time, in Egypt, the development of social and political complexity that led to the civilization of ancient Egypt. Your work in Egypt bears on that, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. That's one of the reasons why we spent over 20 years working out there at a place called Nubta Playa. It started first in 1994, when we first it was an accident. We were driving back in a convoy from a couple hundred miles farther west, and at where we'd been for the field season. And on the way back, we'd stopped at a place, Jebel Nabta was a prominent hill there, and there was a big playa, and we were stopped right at the edge of this playa, and standing around minding our own business, and looked at our feet, around our feet, and there were artifacts all around there, and pottery and so on. So then we sent back a couple of graduate students the following year, and they surveyed the area and found a lot more sites and dug some pits and collected some charcoal, which gave us some spectacular age for pottery out there in the desert, around 8,000 years old. Now we got it back to 9,600 years ago. And then more recently, we've been seeing some signs of complexity in the kinds of religious phenomena that is still preserved out there. Megalithic alignments and tumuli with burials in them, and large stone structures with shaped stones looking possibly like a cow, big cow, weighing several tons. And these were all dug down into the ground and then refilled in pits and so on. And burial mounds with animals in them and as offerings. And these required a lot of social complexity in order to organize them and plan them and pick out the stars and so on. And
yeah, not to mention the size of the stones that were necessary to move.
Oh, yes. And they some of those things, it was a real challenge for us to move them around a bit. And
how old are these features?
The oldest things seem to be about 6,500, 6,700 years ago.
I see. So those would predate the pyramids of Egypt.
They predate, but shortly after 5,000, it got too dry out there, and people moved somewhere. And they may have moved toward the Nile Valley. It wasn't very far away. And one of the suggestions we've published is that it may have stimulated the rise of complexity there in southern Egypt, that the first traces of complexity in the Nile Valley seem to be in that area. These are pre-dynastic in the Nile Valley, but our stuff is before the pre-dynastic, that is, it dates before that.
I see.
Not great times, about 1,000 years before signs of initial complexity in the Nile.
Well, Fred, we could go on and talk about this for a long time because there's so much to talk about. Unfortunately, we don't have all that much time.
Well,
but we do have a book.
Book.
We do have a book called Desert Days,
yeah.
My Life as a Field Archaeologist by Dr. Fred Wendorf, which contains a lot of this detail and a lot of your personal anecdotes, which I find very engaging. And I want to thank you.
By the way, there's a review of the book. It just came out in Antiquity, British Antiquity.
Oh, I see.
Okay.
I'm sure that won't be the last review. People are going to be talking about this book. But I want to thank you again for taking the time to speak with me and to share your experiences with people.
Well, it's been great visiting with you, and thank you for your interest.
Well, thank you very much, Fred.